Well, what we track is something called Assisted Housing Budget Authority, and that is that amount of money that the Congress has authorized the administration to spend on housing assistance for low-income people, and that includes building housing, such as public housing or Section 8 housing, and housing for the elderly or housing for the disabled. And it also includes providing rent subsidies to help people make up the difference between what they can pay and what their housing costs. And that's both through HUD as well as through the rural programs in the Department of Agriculture. And we had a peak of what we call Assisted Housing Budget Authority in 1978, when it was about $70 billion a year. That has dramatically declined over time, and is this year about $30 billion. And so what you see is that we've, and it's been at about that state since the early 1980s. We've had very small increases recently, but the dramatic cut in programs occurred in the late 1970s and early 1980s. It is, and at this point, what we see is, you know, huge waiting list for housing assistance, but nobody, but insufficient supply of housing assistance. You know, this year, Congress will appropriate about 17,000 new housing vouchers in comparison to, you know, minimally 5 million households that have acute housing cost burdens that are low-income households. Mm-hmm. So when you look at what they're spending in comparison to what it is that the need is, it's outrageous. We are very comfortable saying that had we continued at that rate of investment, that is, that we'd continue to create more housing stock and provide more housing assistance, that we certainly could have prevented the contemporary homelessness that had its rapid rise in the early and mid-1980s, and then again in the recession of the early 90s, and now is rising again. And that it's not a coincidence that homelessness accelerated at the same time that we saw the investment in housing go down.
If people take the medication that they're told to take, go to the counseling sessions, and they're quote-unquote, you know, good mental health consumers, is there enough housing for all those people that they can right away get off the streets?
Well, people aren't being offered it. Here in Eugene, Oregon, for instance, there's a lot of people who are following the program, but there's just not adequate housing being offered, or else it's something like the Mission that a lot of people don't like, that's mm-hmm. overcrowded, and that there's a number of people tested positive for indications of TB and so forth.
We just did a whole analysis of last year's housing subsidies from the federal government, and 62.3% of all federal housing subsidy dollars went to households earning over $135,000 a year. 13.8% went to households earning over $63,000 a year. So you got 75% of our housing subsidy dollars are benefiting households earning over $60,000 a year, and 25% is left for everybody else.
I've been sort of like on my own mission. I've been, every time I go someplace, I kind of visit to see how homeless people are treated by the police. And I had the, one of the most eye-opening experiences I've ever had was in San Francisco, where this woman was sitting on the sidewalk next to her shopping cart, and I was going I was taking pictures of the NASA, which is our street conference that they have every year, North American Street Newspaper Conference, and I was bringing my film over to Walgreens, and I happened to be talking to these people, and when I walked away, and all of a sudden a police car pulled up, walked up to the woman, stood her up, put her hands behind her back and handcuffed her, and began to search her. And this woman wasn't selling drugs. She didn't look like she was high. The only crime she had committed was sitting on the sidewalk with other homeless people. She was watching their carts. And they proceeded to go through her shopping cart and take the shopping cart. I mean, it was just a very degrading experience.
What that woman was talking about and what she witnessed is, unfortunately, what we see every day and what we know other communities see every day. I had a guy that came into my office today that was incarcerated, put in jail on Sunday night for sleeping in a subway station that didn't get out till today. Now, that's not as dramatic as shooting somebody or beating somebody up or whatever, but that is the standard operating procedure for how the San Francisco Police Department deals with seeing or running into or bumping into a homeless person. Is that person's committing a crime, you know? Mm-hmm. And if they have a shopping cart, it's a stolen shopping cart. If they have a stolen shopping cart, then they can search your belongings. If you're in possession or you're blocking a sidewalk or you're in possession of a shopping cart, they can run warrant checks on you, you know? And when you can get warrants, which are tickets that you haven't been able to pay for things like blocking a sidewalk, intent to lodge, urinating, defecating, being in a park after hours. They now have a law in San Francisco that says you disobeyed a sign.
Mm.
And if the sign says the park is closed at 10 o'clock and you're in the park after 10 o'clock at night, then you not only get a ticket for being in the park, you also get a ticket, another $76 ticket, for disobeying the sign that tells you that you weren't supposed to be in the park.
Yeah, I think we need to just be more aware about the future and look at the planet as a whole and realize that maybe we need to, like, shed our skins like snakes do if we want to go forward and evolve as a species, and maybe, like, think of a society where we take care of each other as needs more rather than making money being the priority. And that's why you know, there's a lot of homelessness, because private property is sacred, and you need money to have a place to live, and we're the only species that charges rent on each other. You don't see the seals doing that, or the birds charging rent on other birds. And so if we're so intelligent, why aren't we living more intelligently as a society? So I think the problem is it's not people that are the problem. It's the way we've organized society, and maybe we should have a universal rent strike.
Oh, there's an interesting idea. What do you think of that, Donald, a universal rent strike?
Well, I think that'd be a fabulous idea. I think I actually, you know, my thoughts are that we do need to get back to some of the tactics that we used during some of the other movements that have been successful in this country. I'm a strong proponent of civil disobedience. I think we need rapid response teams that go into communities when there are really egregious acts against homeless people. I fully believe that, you know, those tactics worked before and they can work again. 40%, and in some places, in Cincinnati, for instance, 60% of the people that are in shelters work every day. But it makes really no difference at all if you work, if you're not being paid a livable wage.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the solutions that we're working towards is a universal livable wage, which would be indexed to the cost of housing in a particular community.
Oftentimes, what will happen is when there's a large international event in any particular city, that city will come through and they will try to, quote, clean up the city, unquote, by basically trying to make the homeless people or the squatters look as invisible as possible. And the way they often do it, there's some sort of examples from the Philippines that are particularly stark. There was a beauty pageant in the Philippines, a Miss Universe beauty pageant there in 1973, and they cleared, I believe, like 1 mile swaths of vacant land. They cleared squatters for a mile on either side of the road from the airport to the main hall where the Miss Universe pageant was going to happen, so that to sort of beautify the area. And they did the same thing a few years later when an International Monetary Fund, IMF, conference happened in Manila. They cleared out all the squatters in between in order to make it look more beautiful for potential investors and international bankers. So this sort of thing happens a lot.
Certainly the Olympics, wherever the Olympics go, homeless people get swept. It's a disgrace. What happens to homeless people in Atlanta? It happened in Sydney. It happened in Los Angeles. And Sherry, you're in Salt Lake City because of this very issue right now.
Absolutely. It closed the only homeless health care clinic until after the Olympics. I'm not sure what homeless people are supposed to do in terms of getting ill during the Winter Olympics. They have also done the horrible tactics of offering one-way tickets out of town anywhere, but there certainly is an effort to make them disappear during the Winter Olympics.
I'm very nervous. I've been disabled with a disability. I have gone through all kinds of little local agencies, like the lady with the brain injury. I've had brain trauma, so I can't remember things quickly. The problem is I have intelligence, but when I have a problem with the disability, I have difficulty thinking and so on and so forth. But my point is, everything I've heard these people say is true. I'm from a middle-class home. But because of the injuries and the illness, I can no longer be a part of normal society. And I keep thinking that there's an answer out there. And I know now, through these agencies, there aren't any answers.
On a global scale, homelessness is so broad. The problem of poverty to such an extent that people don't have enough funds to purchase even the most basic amounts of shelter. It's a problem that is sort of stunning in its scope, and that as bad it is as it is in the United States, I think it's also important to remember that it's 10 times or 100 times worse in the third world.
If I was going to go, Walter, to a major city, let's just take Zurich as an example, in Switzerland, would I see people sleeping on the streets?
No, I can say that you would probably not find anybody sleeping in the streets these last years. There has been a period about 10 years ago where you would have found people, but there were other circumstances. Now, you wouldn't find anybody, or you may find, let's see, very, very few, but you would have to look very, very sharp to find somebody.
Okay. Is that, John, the same situation in, say, Toronto? Would I have to look very hard to find someone sleeping on the street in Toronto?
You wouldn't have to look very hard at all. There's a considerable number of people sleeping on the streets, and the shelters for homeless people have mushroomed in terms of their use over the last number of years. Not only would you see people sleeping on the streets, but if you were a regular visitor to the city, you'd be struck by the fact that the numbers of people sleeping on the streets and the other signs of very visible signs of homelessness have increased dramatically and are increasing dramatically.
Do you think that what they do in Canada and in Ontario is similar or dissimilar from what's being done in America?
Well, the short answer is that it is similar, but I spoke a moment ago about the increase in the number of homeless, and corresponding to that, there's an increasing similarity between social policy in this country and that pursued in the United States.
Walter, let me ask you the same thing, the short answer to start.
Yeah, I think there are differences. There are clear differences because people have some rights when they are homeless, and mm-hmm. I think that makes difference. It's not because Switzerland is simply a rich country that you won't find so much homelessness, but I think the basic point is really that communities and cities don't want to have people in the streets, homelessness. So I think it's first of all a political commitment that we want to fight against homelessness in the streets. And therefore, they are taking a set of measures which try to bring alternatives to the people. And I think the important thing is that there is no miracle and there is no simple recipe, but there is a need for a couple of measures which help. And to make it very short, I think, first of all, there must be a place where people can go when they are threatened by homelessness. Then there must be housing provided, adequate housing provided by the community, and the financial means must be provided so that people can pay the minimal rents. And last point, but important point, very often it is linked to health problems, and the health services must be available for the homeless people.
When the provincial government here in Ontario cut social assistance rates by 21.6%, there was an immediate increase in the number of people using emergency shelters for the homeless in Toronto of 67%. So the correlation is completely obvious. And the situation here has been dominated for a number of years by the fact that it has been generally very shocking to people to see this huge increase in visible homelessness. But of course, over a period of time, society adjusts to seeing something like this, and now you're starting to get politicians feel comfortable with very, very regressive measures, so that a few years ago the city of Toronto declared homelessness a disaster as a result of very large-scale public pressure. This week there are discussions going on in Toronto to declare a moratorium on the creation of any further shelters for homeless people, on the basis that the city is overloaded with homeless shelters, and as long as they are built, homeless people will keep utilizing them. So if we close them down, homeless people will go away, which is of course absurd.
Carrie, I know that you have spent time being homeless in rural areas. How did you come to be homeless and then stay in a rural area as opposed to coming into an urban area for services?
Well, when I first arrived here in Maine, I came from South Carolina, and I was fighting homelessness there due to domestic violence. So I came to the state of Maine because I always wanted to live here. I always liked the lighthouses. And when I got here, I wound up in Portland trying to find housing. And I wasn't able to find housing in Portland. We were here in August. And we were working through Labor Ready, you know, and living out of our car. And we were fortunate. We had a car, you know, but it wasn't a good one, but we did have one. And we wound up meeting a gentleman that allowed us to stay in his camper for a couple weeks. Well, right in that same area, it was the Sebago area that the camper existed. Well, down the road, there was a gentleman moving out that we got hooked up with. Well, we thought he was the landlord. We were told he was the landlord. And it turned out that he wasn't the landlord. He was the person being evicted out of there. So we got into a big deal with the landlord saying, oh, you're friends with this person and I'm not going to rent to you. And then when he found out, hey, we were the victim there too, you know, he realized, hey, you know, I'm going to give these people a chance. And we went through a lot that first year. We had absolutely no heat on Christmas, absolutely none. We lived all winter with no water. There was a hole in my bathroom floor the size of the whole toilet area, and the toilet sat forward when you sat down. And I was down with pneumonia 3 times this last year because of my disabilities and the fact that I was exposed to all those elements, you know. And we had to come into Portland to work every day. So I wound up, I had a ticket in South Carolina that because of my situation didn't get taken care of, and I lost my license. okay? So it was only on suspension until that ticket was paid, so I not only had to take care of my license, I was getting tickets because I was driving into Portland to work.
Now, Carrie, you mentioned that you can get some transportation access when you do have health issues.
Yeah, through RTP, but if I were to marry my significant other, no, then we'd be stuck.
And why is that?
Because through marriage, they automatically assume that he is now responsible for that part of my medical stuff. And on our present budget, there's no way we could ever get married. He couldn't afford my medical bills, number one. And number two, he could not afford to take that risk with me as far as getting me into a hospital, because all services medically would be cut off for me.
You know, through Mary Ann's work with the York County Initiative to End Homelessness, we finally completed the research that indicates in all of York County last year, the general assistance offices in the 29 towns managed not to spend 87% of the money.
And I want to let our national listeners know that York County is that the largest county or the second largest?
No, it's probably second largest.
I guess I'm thinking population-wise.
It's the most southern county, and we have kind of a gold coast along the coast, some very expensive property, and you get the other side of the interstate into the hills, and we have a lot of hill people. We have a lot of rural poverty in that area. But in that county, again, they managed deliberately not to spend 87% of the money that the towns were required by law to allocate for assistance to the poor.
Now, where did that money go? I'm sorry, Mary.
It went right back into their general fund at the end of the year when they completed their task, which was not to spend it so they could put it back into other town expenditures.
And across the state, 76% of the money didn't get spent.
Here we have people stacked up like cordwood in shelters in Portland and Alfred, Maine, and all over the state of Maine, and there's a concerted effort not to spend the money that would help them provide the housing assistance to get out of the shelters.
Right, and of course that's the purpose of the money.
Because there was so much hunger that had reemerged in the United States, and because of our need to focus more, even though our name was World Hunger Year, most of our work has been domestic hunger and poverty. And our line here that we use for this is innovative solutions to hunger and poverty. So we've gone all over the country and visited hundreds and hundreds of groups. And we have a database of some 6,000 or 7,000 groups all over the country that deal with hunger and poverty and that are trying to do more than just provide emergency food and shelter. They may be doing some of that, and I'm sure the food bank does, but they also are developing other kinds of programs to help people to be self-reliant.
Bill, I only half heard what you said. I don't mean to be rude, but something you don't know. There's a little bit of a commotion here at the broadcast site, and what has happened, I started this broadcast by I lit a candle for all the homeless people who die homeless and are dying this very night. What I did not expect, we have a group of homeless people who've been here with us through the night. We've had food. We've tried to make a kind of block party for homeless people. And we just found out that one of the homeless people who was here tonight died during the night.
Oh, that's terrible. I'm so sorry to hear that.
And the ambulance is here now, and they're putting this person in a body bag. And,
oh, that's terrible.
So I don't know what caused this death. I don't even know this person's name. I don't even know if this was somebody who was on the show or not. I don't know any more than I've just told you, but this
sure
is a very somber and very sad occasion here, and I guess everybody's a little bit discombobulated. But
well, unfortunately, this is not a unique experience.
This is
something that happens pretty much every day in America.
Well, I tell you what, I'm told that his name is Lee, so I'd like to just have a moment of silence for Lee.
Absolutely.
Well, I can't just leave dead air here, but
I guess this just drives home the point all the more, and even though I don't know Lee's story, I sure as hell know that Lee would have been better off in a house.